Okay. Our next speaker is Dr. Donald Hanley, who is currently professor of terrorism and asymmetric warfare at the National Warfare Studies at the National Defense Intelligence College. He has a PhD in military history from George Washington. He's a former Air Force intelligence officer, and he's written two books, one on terrorism in 1989 and the second on the Army Air Force's guided bomb program in World War II. So, Dr. Hanley, oh, there, please, welcome.
Okay, good morning. I am Dr. Hanley, and I do teach at the National Defense Intelligence College. I primarily teach terrorism. I do teach some analysis. My intelligence career started 33 years ago. This summer, when I washed out of NAV school, the Air Force asked me what I wanted to do, and I said, I'd like to be a weather officer. They said, great, you're going to intel school, and so I've been. let me start by giving you the boilerplate here. Please don't blame the federal government or my college or anybody else for anything you hear this morning. These are all my words. Okay. This is what we're really going to talk about. What do analysts need to know about terrorism, and how do we get them there in terms of epistemologies, pedagogies, approaches, and methods? Being an educator, I think about this problem set from the standpoint of core learning outcomes. And, of course, one of the very first core learning outcomes I want the analysts to know, is they've got to be able to identify the phenomenon when they see it. And this is more difficult to do than you might imagine. As many people as there are in the room, that's how many definitions of terrorism we have, and so we have to understand what the heck we are talking about. What is the phenomenon we are actually examining? Well, the second bullet here goes a long way to telling us what it is, because terrorism functions in a very unique way. What are those unique things that are happening? We have to make sure that the analyst understands the uniqueness of it. And then they have to be able to identify the type of terrorism, because terrorism comes in different flavors. And depending on the different flavor it comes in, gives us the idea that it can have different strengths and weaknesses within the socio-political context in which that terrorism is functioning. They have to be able to select and apply properly use the appropriate theoretical approaches. There are as many approaches as there are people in this room. I'm going to talk about five of them this morning. And they have to be able, and most importantly of all, they need to be able to identify gaps in intelligence, because that drives requirements. So changing this to the analyst himself, basically we want the analyst to understand the terrorism phenomenon, the nature and unique characteristics, capabilities, utility, strengths, and weaknesses. These are the things that the analyst is basically being asked to do. Okay, we want you to be able to understand this. And in terms of the flavors, the type that we tend to focus on the most in the Department of Defense is insurgent and revolutionary. Anarchical terrorism is, of course, emerging with emergence of third-generation gangs, for example, the activity we have going on right now in Mexico. Ethnic genocidal, transnational, state-sponsored. These can be hybrids, by the way. You can find a transnational insurgent or revolutionary organization or one that happens to be state-sponsored. And then criminal terrorism and so on and so on and so on. Each flavor has its own strengths and capabilities and weaknesses. Basically, we want all our analysts to be able to do the following things. What is the composition of this organization? What is its disposition? Where is it located? And what form is it located? Capabilities, intent, both tactically, that is when, where, how, and why are they going to strike their next target, and at the same time strategically, what are the political ends that they're seeking to achieve, and I can't stomp this enough, what is it that you don't know? What is it that you don't know about this particular organization? Here are the theoretical approaches I'm going to very briefly go through this morning, and the ones that I use in my course on terrorism. Motivational theory, which focuses on the individual choices that the individual might make. Structural theory, that gets us into group dynamics and so forth. Military theory, arts and science of war. I can't stomp this strongly enough. The bottom line is that most people walk into my classroom, even those in uniform, I should even say especially those in uniform, who are not sufficiently steeped in the notion in the school of the military arts and sciences. And as a result, I spend about 20% of my class actually trying to get them up to speed on something that they allegedly already know something about. Open systems theory, this is where we get into process. And then I'm going to talk very briefly about revolutionary mobilization theory to focus on revolutionary or insurgent forms of terrorism. All right, first motivational theory, of course, this goes back to Ted Robert Gurr, his great work, Why Men Rebel. He's examining two variables simultaneously, value expectations versus value capabilities. The delta that you see there, obviously, is what defines relative deprivation. And in fact, I have the students track four perceived conditions within a terrorist-targeted constituency. The terrorists are seeking to mobilize a constituency. To what extent is that constituency experiencing relative deprivation? By the way, who else in that environment is not experiencing relative deprivation, and where do those cleavages lie? What is the source of that, perceived source of that relative deprivation? The terrorists are going to definitely try to inculcate in the minds of these people who that is or what that might be. The perceptions for a chance for success and perception of what constitutes a better tomorrow. Okay, so this is the individual piece of it. Then we move to the group piece of it. Here's, in other words, structural theory based upon Theda Skocpol's work, States and Social Revolutions, and that's the principal textbook I use. It offers an understanding of organizations as being something other than a homogenous unit. And it's amazing to me the shorthand that we use often that Iran wants or Al-Qaeda needs or desires tends to cause analysts to focus on these actors as if they're individuals and that they're homogenous. And indeed, they are not. And in fact, within groups, in every group, there are internal cleavages and interest groups. And I ask my analysts, my students, to identify what are the subgroupings and what is the differences in their interests and so forth. Because if they can identify these disparate groups, this gives us potential points of friction that we can either exacerbate by putting asymmetric strain on the system or perhaps capitalize upon them in some other way, shape, or form. Let me talk very briefly about military arts and science. I could spend all day, in fact, I spend two full weeks talking about this in the class because the students don't know this. And in fact, most of the people that I talk to that are trying to deal with terrorism do not understand this on the level that I think that they need to understand it. First of all, warfare is not just kinetic. Okay, it is not just making your enemy unable to fight you. The warfare functions on all three domains simultaneously, physical, cognitive, and moral. The cognitive, we're trying to create uncertainty that has increased the capability or the situation where we have superior situational awareness over our opponent, or conversely create conditions where he doesn't have superior situational awareness. But most importantly of all is on the moral domain. In the moral domain, what we're seeking to achieve here is we're trying to create conditions whereby our opponent is no longer willing to continue to wage war against us, to continue to employ lethal force. And this is where victory actually occurs in the war on terrorism, as you will see shortly. Principles of war and combat. It's amazing to me that we have people coming into my classroom and into the Department of Defense and have been in the Department of Defense for as long as a decade that do not have a handle on the principles of war and combat. We are at war. Many of these forms of terrorism are, in fact, a form of war. Therefore, the principles of war and combat apply. And you ignore these principles at your peril. Oh, by the way, so do the terrorists. And we're seeing the terrorists repeatedly making grievous mistakes because they apparently haven't studied this as well. Cohesion, this idea that organizations function in the moral domain in terms of what is it that keeps this organization together? What keeps it continuing to function to try to achieve its mission when they are facing great privation and danger and so forth? Well, there are elements of cohesion that every analyst needs to understand as well. Centers of gravity analysis. This goes back to the great work of Carl von Clausewitz. And to a certain extent, the further works by Little Hart and others. Basically, within every military organization or within any combat organization, there are things that if you were to eliminate it, the organization would lose its cohesion, it would shatter, and it would no longer be able to function in physical space and time. There can be many of these. There's not just one of them. There could be many different kinds. It could be supplies. It could be communication. It could be decision-making. It could be any number of factors. Understanding strategy versus operational and tactics. I have a lot of folks coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq, some of them wounded, who are very, very, very quick to jump to conclusions as to what it is that's going to work. They just came back. They're going to tell me what works. And many of them think that they're going to win this war by piling up a whole bunch of tactical victories, and then that's going to equal a strategic outcome. And they need to understand that strategy, tactics, and operations they're interrelated, but they function on different planes. And you need to start with a strategy, not with a tactics. The difference between warriors and soldiers. This is an argument I am constantly having with the Department of Defense. Many soldiers tell me their very best soldiers are warriors. Well, that's great, but you just took this word that meant something to the historical community for over 500 years. You took this word and you turn it into something else. Soldiers fight as cohesive units. Warriors do not. In fact, warriors often see combat as a sacrament. It's a sacred act or a sacred rite. How do you defeat a warrior who thinks that the combat itself is what he's all about versus a soldier who goes to war to achieve a political outcome? Orders of magnitude difference in terms of understanding how you're going, why this person is on the battlefield and what it is they're seeking to achieve. Weapons, shock versus fire. This is the most fundamental thing I could talk about today, but it's misunderstood by a lot of people who are in uniform. I'm a former Air Force guy, so I'll pick on them. The Air Force does not understand the limitations of fire. Fire being projectile weapons. A projectile weapon by itself cannot compel your enemy to surrender. The enemy can choose to surrender, but it's up to him. Whereas a shock weapon, an infantryman, can actually physically occupy space and the people that are there, as well as control the resources. When shock meets fire, fire by itself cannot stand alone. Why is this important? Terrorists are fire weapons. They are not shock weapons. Pure terrorists are fire weapons. And then the evolution of war over time, getting back to the history of war. What has changed and what has remained constant? It's crucial that the students and the analysts understand this. Bottom line is I spend a great deal of time trying to teach them what they do not know about war, okay, and try to get them back to understanding make them understand what they brought to the classroom may not be actually the truth about war. All right, now I want to get into open systems theory here, and I'm going to use this as an exemplar. We're going to go a little bit deeper than I've gone so far. This is, of course, based on the great work of Ludwig Bertalanffy back in the 1950s, early 1960s, adapted by Troy Thomas and Bill Casper at the Air Force Academy, who applied open systems theory to violent non-state actors or terrorists. And basically, they said that, yes, the unit of analysis is, in fact, the terrorist organization or the violent non-state actor, but we have to understand it in terms of how it interacts with its environment, and we also have to understand its subsystems. So bear with me as we go through this very quickly. The question that Bill and Troy were asking is, how do you get this little kid right here, little innocent guy right here, to decide some point in his life that his only answer is to climb up on this armored personnel carrier and join this militia? What is the process that happens? Well, they say within the environment, what we've got here is a whole series of inputs that everything from resource scarcity to identity cleavages and so forth, the government, or what serves as a government in that arena, either cannot or will not address those. The output could be any one of these things here to include vigilantes or militia groups. These become reinforcing actions, and what we have is, of course, identity mobilization. What my students I ask them to do is identify these situations in the environment and tell me what you think would be necessary for us to interdict this process. What is it? How would we create conditions whereby this little guy would choose a different outcome or a different approach than perhaps climbing up there and joining that militia group? The next level we go to, of course, is the system itself. All systems have these characteristics. I ask my students and the analysts to take a look at these characteristics. They have to be able to apply them when they're looking at whatever terrorist organization they're looking at. They need to understand, that, of course, that as it imports energy and converts it, that output does not necessarily only mean physical outputs, not just terrorists, but it can be information. It could be something else. For example, Lebanese Hezbollah, one of their most important outputs are hospitals that are available to anyone in South Lebanon, okay, which creates an environment where this system can not only exist, but it can thrive. The other thing is that they need to understand that this organism goes from gestation to growth to maturity and then transformation. Transformation in living beings is death. Transformation for political organisms is, hopefully for them, a higher form of political organization. What are the indicators that this organism is on the verge of transforming to a higher order of organization? These are also questions that the students must grapple with regard to their particular terrorist organization. Then we get to the subsystems. Now, in the subsystems, I'm not going to go through them all, but each one of them has a specialized function. The question is, for example, we'll take support, recruitment. To what extent is this system able to recruit qualified individuals and convert them into production in terms of operations? This gets us into the notion of congruence. How well do all of these things work together? And by the same token, we as analysts, can we perceive any weaknesses that are there, that perhaps we can interject additional asymmetries or additional strains on the system that would cause perhaps their recruiting to fall off, which then affects the quality of their output, because this is a feedback loop, it is open systems, would adversely affect their input. In other words, what we're trying to do is get them I ask my students to think in terms of increasing the cost of negative entropy, that is, being able to offset the natural entropy in all things. How do we increase the cost of negative entropy, not only in the physical domain, but in the cognitive and moral domains? And these are issues that the students grapple with whatever terrorist organization they're examining. This brings us back to identity mobilization. Here we get back into the environment. We start talking in terms of the constituency that the terrorists are seeking to mobilize. What are the myths that are there, and how is that terrorist organization trying to tap into that myth? One of the most important actors in this period is called the identity entrepreneur. He's throwing an idea out onto this constituency, and he's trying to see to what extent that constituency is rising to the bait, if you will. How well is this resonating with that particular constituency? For example, with Al-Qaeda, their narrative is based upon the myth of the lost golden age, okay? The loss of the great caliphate, which is depicted here on this map, the largest empire known to man to this point in time. Osama bin Laden says that this golden age was that period, and he claims the caliphate was lost because of a loss of faith and an erosion of the Muslim ideals. And this is, he is an identity entrepreneur, projects this concept out onto his constituency to see to what extent they are in fact resonating with them. Identity entrepreneurs, all they have is an idea. Think of Hitler circa 1923. He took this idea and he converted it into Nazi Germany eventually. This is the bridge, by the way, between motivational individuals, or motivational theory, which focuses on individuals, and open systems theory, which is looking at a group phenomenon. And this is a problem, of course, as all of you know, moving from individuals to group and trying to make these things marry up. The identity entrepreneur is critically important, especially early on in the process. The analyst has to identify who the identity entrepreneur is. That's usually not hard. When I brief the Joint Military Attaché School, I tell them, you guys will see him. He's out there on the street corner. He can't hide his light under a bushel. He's got to get this idea out. It's going to be out there. Now, it may be in a means or a manner that we won't pick it up through national technical means, but you'll be there, so you might see him on the street corner pounding his message into the folks. The analyst also has to understand the message and how that message is in fact being packaged. That means we have to determine who the audience is. What constituency is it that is supposed to react to this? Ascertain whether or not it is in fact resonating, and then I ask them to think in terms of facilitating the construction of a counter-narrative. Again, this is increasing the cost of negative entropy, not on the physical domain, but on the cognitive. All right, revolutionary mobilization. This is based upon the book you heard about earlier back in 1989, but also based upon the works of Mao Zedong and Thomas Thornton. Bear with me here very, very quickly. This is how revolutions unfold, according to Mao, Thornton, and me. You have a preparatory phase. We're in the preparatory phase because it's pre-violent. The whole purpose is to establish a cause. Your principal actor out here would be the identity entrepreneur. Now, as you go through gestation, growth, and so forth, transformation, well, as they get prepared to transform, they start feeling their oats, they think it's time for us to take this to the next step, I'm asking my analyst, what are the indicators that they're ready to go? Well, of course, there'll be certain kinds of training and so forth. They get to the initial violence phase, they're going to be using primarily terrorism. Now, remember, terrorism is a fire unit or a fire force or a weapon. It goes out and it seeks to morally isolate that constituency seeking to mobilize from the population or from the government. It's trying to separate the two, shatter the cohesion, socio-political cohesion between that constituency and the government. If this works, they move to the expansion phase. The actor is a guerrilla. Now, a guerrilla is a very weak shock force, but it is a shock force. Being a shock force, it can occupy terrain. That means it can come into the villages, perhaps only at night, like the Viet Cong. And now it physically isolates the population from the regime. And now they establish what the local rules and laws are going to be. Think about Fallujah in 2004. 40 miles due west of Baghdad, for about 6 months, the guerrillas were actually physically controlling Fallujah, establishing Sharia law and punishing people according to Sharia law. If this works, they get to conventional. Eventually, they defeat the government. Then the red terror comes back in. Think of the guillotine. You're going to have to reprogram the population and so forth. Well, why am I telling you all this? Well, basically, the thing that the analyst and I are seeking to establish as absolute truth right now, it's our working hypothesis, is that if we can keep them in the terrorism phase, that is, they cannot physically control terrain, the ultimate effect of this is that the revolution will fail, because what ultimately happens is that the terrorists themselves end up morally isolating themselves from the very constituency they originally sought to mobilize. Eventually, folks get tired. They say, you know what? Take your silly idea and go elsewhere. We're done. Okay? We saw this with Catholic mothers in Northern Ireland. We saw this with, of course, the collapse of the Bader-Meinhof gang, the Red Brigades in Italy, and on and on and on. I can give you many examples. The bottom line here, the objective, build a strategy for understanding a given terrorist group or movement using all five approaches simultaneously. It's a qualitative in nature. It's holistic as possible as we possibly can. You can see, of course, it's incredibly complex. Multidisciplinary. It focuses upon identifying the unknowns, the capabilities, and the intents of the organism. And the ultimate goal here for the intelligence analyst is, of course, first to prevent surprise. That's the ultimate bottom line for all intelligence everywhere in the world. And then secondly, to defeat the enemy, whoever they happen to be, the terrorist organization, by morally isolating them from the very constituency they seek to defeat. If you go out there and try to kill them all, you'll lose. You're going to have to go out there and create a condition whereby they cannot resonate with that group that they're seeking to mobilize. And I guess I'll take questions when we have the Q&A session. Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.